Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer of the show, and I'm pleased to introduce our Clinical Air series. This is number 11, and it's dedicated to the topic, or should I say the question of, who could disrupt or complement the pharma industry, especially as it deals with digital? Our host is Craig Lipset, Head of Clinical Innovation, R&D at Pfizer, and our guest is Donald Jones. Don wears a couple of hats, but I will introduce him as the Chief Digital Officer at the Scripps Translational Science Institute. Both Craig and Don are speaking at the DPharm conference, which is about disrupting innovations to advance clinical trials, and this program takes place September 11 and 12 in Boston. So I am delighted to have both of these industry leaders talking together about digital and disruption in pharma. And with that, I will hand the mic over to Craig. So hello, Craig.
Hello, Val, and thank you so much for that great introduction. This is Craig Lipset from Pfizer, and my little opening disclaimer that the opinions that I'll be sharing while I am an employee of Pfizer and serve on the board for a few other organizations, these do represent my opinions, although I certainly hope and aspire that they represent those of those other organizations with which I'm affiliated. So Val, what a great way to start to wrap up our summer with Clinical Air Episode 11. I'm joining from here in New York City, and it is an absolutely beautiful day today, but a great day to have a great conversation along the theme of all of ours for the first 10 episodes, some interesting people doing some amazing things. And I just can't believe that we have had over 4,000 listeners to those first few episodes. I am not quite sure who all of you are. I think that my mother has been very busy getting all of her friends out there to download the show. So if that's the case, I'll say hi to Sandy. But if you are what I think, and some other folks from either the digital circles or the clinical research circles or folks that are living at this convergence of the two, welcome aboard. One thing I just wanted to acknowledge, Val, since we are on episode 11, is just to flash back for folks. If you haven't had a chance to listen to some of the prior episodes, the last episode we had packaged, episode number 10, go take a listen and then go open you don't even have to open the Wall Street Journal from July 30th because it's right there on the cover. That episode 11 was our conversation with patient Jerry Burchill, and we were really excited to see the journal pick up on that conversation with Jerry in their cover story on July 30th. You know, there's a reference at the end of that article about Jerry and I meeting and how we had met in the past and actually shared a stage at a conference. That conference was DPharm 2 years ago, the Disruptive Innovations Conference. So hopefully that gives folks a sense of what's in store in just a few short weeks up in Boston. So with that, I'm going to pivot a little bit. And Val, I'm not sure if you know who Jim Phelps is, but you are my Jim Phelps. Jim Phelps, for the TV and movie fans out there, is from Mission Impossible. And I'm not talking about the Tom Cruise Jim Phelps. You're like the Peter Graves 1960s classic Jim Phelps. Because,
okay.
Val, I send you on, I believe, impossible missions. You ask me who would be some of the most fantastic people to have on the stage at DPharm or on the show here on the podcast, and I love to give you names that are just downright impossible for you to possibly get on the air. And yet here we are with Don Jones, Chief Digital Officer at Scripps, and I'm not going to be shy about saying Don is really at the hub of digital health. He is considered to be really one of the key opinion leaders. Largely, you know, I met Don when he was at Qualcomm and was a pioneer around driving Qualcomm around health. And, you know, now we see Don with a number of new hats he's wearing. So With that, Don, welcome to Clinical Air.
Thank you, Craig. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the introduction. Very kind of you.
So, Don, you have a few different titles on your email signature with Scripps and the Wireless Life Sciences Alliance and a few other roles, and even just the title of Chief Digital Officer at Scripps Translational Science Institute is so intriguing. What is your day job, Don? What do these roles actually mean or roll up to?
Well, maybe a little bit of history will help explain. I spent 11 years at Qualcomm kind of answering the question, what should a wireless company that works on digital chip technologies and intellectual property to create communication systems and networks do in the healthcare space? Where could it have its role? And during that time, I had the pleasure of meeting Eric Topol 7 years ago when he first came to La Jolla, California, from the Cleveland Clinic era. And I collaborated with Eric on his first CTSA grant, which is the largest NIH grant given, and we created a digital health component of that program on the 5-year grant. And in that, we actually created a master's degree program in wireless health for physicians, which arguably was likely the first in the world focused on training physicians in applied wireless technologies into healthcare. And it was also the beginning of me getting to know Eric and getting to know his interests. And we collaborated over that period of years. We co-founded together the West Wireless Health Institute, now called the West Health Institute. We brought that concept to Gary and Mary West, who graciously funded it. And we continued to collaborate, and it became clearer and clearer to me that what I was calling at the time wireless health, and today more is called digital health or connected health, was now not a question of if, but a question of or even when, but a question really more of how and where the business models and the ROIs found. And it became clearer and clearer we needed to develop clinical evidence. So Eric and I again collaborated, and just over a year ago, we created the world's first clinical trial center focused exclusively on clinical trials that involve digital health. And I like to say that what holds these trials together is that the patient or trial participant is actually a node on the internet during the trial. These are horizontal in terms of clinical areas, in terms of what's being tested, devices, drugs, combinations, et cetera, but the patient is definitely connected and a data source to the internet during the course of the trial. So we recruited a great clinician and clinical trialist named Steve Steinhubel to run that program just over a year ago. And today there's over 20 trials in progress at the Scripps Center. And so when the past CEO of Qualcomm decided to retire, and he was the gentleman who recruited me, Paul Jacobs, from Qualcomm, and he decided to step into the chairman's role, I decided it was time for me to actually make a kind of a career change and ended up joining Eric here at the Scripps Translational Science Institute to help continue to build out the clinical trials program here at Scripps, which is a complementary program to two other activities we have here. One is genomics research. We do some fairly unique things in the genomics arena compared to a lot of other places. And then we also train physicians as clinical researchers. So I basically have made a little bit of a pivot in my career, and I'm focusing on generating the evidence necessary to get digital applications through, not only through the regulatory challenges, but really more importantly through the adoption challenges in the marketplace, provide the evidence that the healthcare practitioners need and, frankly, in many cases, the consumers want to make decisions for using technologies in conjunction with therapies.
Wow. You know, generating evidence is that's a tall order, right? I mean, when we look at companies like a pharma company manufacturing a chemical, a pill, is almost the easy part, not to disparage, you know, the significant work that goes into the pharmaceutical sciences and manufacturing process, but, you know, generic companies step in at a later date into that in terms of a product's life cycle. Most of what we're in the business of doing is generating and communicating evidence, data, to different stakeholders, regulators, payers, providers, patients. So generating evidence around digital health tools in companion with the other interventions, that's a tall order. Are there any other centers like this that are working to generate this evidence, or is this all fertile ground?
Well, there are a few centers. I've chosen to focus on centers around the world that combine four characteristics. They've got some experience in digital health, some experience in genomics. The reason for the genomics piece is that some of the digital health products actually do involve sequencing. I'd say right now about 15% of our digital health products also involve sequencing. But more importantly, the computational biology back end of genomics supports the same computational requirements necessary in digital health. So they're very, very complementary. And then finally, the clinical trials. And what I've tried to do is actually identify centers from all over the world that have brought those four capabilities, digital health, genomics, computational biology, and clinical trials, under a common roof, where the researchers and other scientists are actually working hand-in-hand together. So I'm not talking about a university that's siloed and different parts of the campus is where you find these skill sets, but really where they're operating together under one roof. So far I've identified about 12 centers around the world, and we're bringing them together into something we call the Global Consortium for Digital Medicine as a global footprint, kind of essentially centers of excellence for digital clinical trials, so that there's a reference point that has is working on the nomenclature, the workflow processes, and the health IT platforms for even conducting these trials, and to do it with a level of consistency and standards that the industry can come to expect. So there are some, but there aren't many, is the short answer to your question.
So we have many of the listeners today will be clinical trialists that are mostly involved with investigational medicines, and we have a long list of obligations and responsibilities, very often standardized in different regions, good clinical practice, ICH, and other rules that we have to abide by, most often protection for the patient, medical and ethical oversight. A lot of that adds a lot of cost and complexity to our clinical trials. For the types of studies that you're doing, say with just a digital tool to generate that evidence, how similar do your clinical trials look and feel to those that some of my colleagues may be doing? Where do there tend to be differences?
Well, that's a great question. We do regulatory trials as well as non-regulatory trials, and truth be told, we like the non-regulatory trials better because they're a lot more fun. There's a lot more freedom in kind of asking open-ended questions, as the audience, I'm sure, will understand and appreciate. The short story about digital technologies applied in a clinical trial where the use case is about making the trial more efficient means that you can actually move towards running the trial and running data collection effectively on a real-time basis. We literally have trials that you see the data collecting on remote screens real-time as it's being collected. You're not waiting for paperwork to be filed. You're actually collecting it, you know, literally at the same moment in time that it's being generated. And this actually portends to trials in the future, several of which we've already run, where effectively the use case goes something like this. The patient candidates discover the trial electronically, often through some kind of social networking combinations. They digitally consent to the trial. FedEx brings them the trial components. Their interactions with the principal investigator are digital, and can include things like video conferencing, and the data is collected digitally, and the patient never actually goes to a trial site. Now, that's kind of the extreme version, but we've actually done that kind of trial. But components of what I've just described are often what we see in the trials at this point. So at the end of the day, the digital technologies compress the time it takes to gather data. In many cases, they allow collection of far more data than previously has been collected, and essentially cut some of the observational time out that goes to ensuring that the data is being collected, because frankly, you know it's being collected on a real-time basis.
I think it's a great example, and I appreciate your sort of bringing that home to sort of walk through something that's a little more real and tangible for folks. There are so many, so much of the process is the same, and while there is a feeling that a highly regulated or controlled trial for an investigational medicine may limit some of our tools, we certainly have, and we've talked about on this show with other guests, studies that are using electronic or digital informed consent processes and similar tools. And so being able to look at and learn from the types of tools and ways that you're engaging patients to run your studies, I think will be very interesting for this audience, both today as well as when we have a chance to talk more in Boston in a few weeks. We often have joked around, what would Google do or what would this company do if they ran clinical trials? But here you are really running exactly that, these digitally enabled trials to test these different interventions. What's gotten in the way, Don, though, of these tools having clinical evidence to date? I've kind of had the hunch, at least, that the barrier has been the cost of the trials, that everybody would love to have evidence, but nobody has, very few, innovators and entrepreneurs in the digital space have the resources to invest in these types of studies. Is that a misperception, or is that still the reality?
Actually, I think it's a misperception. I think the two biggest obstacles I've seen so far working with multiple pharmaceutical companies are fear about changing known processes. In other words, doing something different than we've always done it before, because that inherently holds some risk. And if you're in, especially if you're in a phase three and you're kind of getting, closing in on the commercialization finish line, you don't want to take any risks. So doing things the way you've always done them just feels safer. It's kind of like the old saying from years ago that you couldn't get fired for hiring IBM or Big Blue. And so I think a lot of times the trial folks just don't want to necessarily take on new risks, and any new technology is a new risk. I have literally participated in multiple trials here where one of my jobs was to go find the experts that could come in. These are often physician researchers or physicians in kind of key positions to come in and essentially convince the pharmaceutical company folks that, in fact, yes, this technology is not only doable, it's actually standard of care. And I can just give you an example. I had to bring in the Army's chief medical information officer, a world-famous researcher, and the head of a very well-known Harvard program, three important MDs, probably cost, I'm just going to pick a number, but let's say $25,000 in fees and travel expenses to spend a couple of hours for those three people to come into one pharma company to say that the digital plan for a trial was not only completely doable, but the technologies being proposed had been in practice for more than 20 years.
I have absolutely no doubt that the that the pragmatic and risk-averse pharma companies to date, are cautious. But I also agree, I think that trajectory-wise, that there is almost a necessary evolution because, as you said, these are growing to the extent in healthcare that they are standards of care. But, thinking, though, about the digital tool itself, I kind of have the sense, though, that many of the digital tools lack their own evidence, and that's kind of where it's been almost resource constrained, that I've heard folks at say the mHealth Summit or other places in the past kind of lamenting that you know, they would generate more evidence if it were kind of practical and feasible for them to generate evidence about, say, their app or sensor or combination thereof.
Well, you're absolutely right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There are we're at a stage where there is not a great depth of evidence about any of the particular digital tools. But that being said, I've actually come across more scenarios that said I'm afraid of the device actually providing me more data. Maybe it's actually more accurate, and therefore I might not want to use it. And this is not necessarily the obvious statement, but I'll give you an example. We actually published last January a trial where we compared the Zio ECG patch against traditional Holter monitoring. And that trial very successfully showed that the Zio patch outperformed traditional three-lead Holter monitoring by about 60%. So it was about 160% better from a clinical capture perspective. It was perceived by the patients to be far more comfortable to use, 92% satisfactory to wear for 14 days versus 52% satisfactory to wear a traditional Holter monitor for 24 hours. And on top of that, the cost structure of actually using the Zio patch was significantly less than the overall cost structure of a traditional Holter monitor. So it's kind of a win-win-win. That being said, I've been in conversations with pharma organizations who have said, you know, I don't know that I want that much data because I know how much data I get with the traditional Holter, and I'm comfortable with that amount of data, and having more data may open more questions than having less data. So I don't know whether clinical demonstrations of efficacy of the product and how accurate the product is necessarily the only issue. I think a lot of the issues here in digital are actually going to produce so much more data that it's going to raise this question of how do I use the data. So let me give you an example. I currently have 3 different smart patches in trials. Each of the patches deliver up to 8 physiological data streams, one of which includes SpO2 and continuous blood pressure. If we just set aside the issues that the traditional trial data platforms don't even have a place to put the data and just say, you know, guess what? We've never really had continuous blood pressure outside of an ICU and an art line. We've never had that data, so we've never actually know what the blood pressure looks like, you know, continuously over a trial period. Do we really want to introduce that data stream into our trial? So I think there's 2 separate issues here. One is the device validated, and secondly, do we want to open the potential Pandora's box if we collect that much information?
You know, it's a Pandora's box, but it's also, you know, fear of the unknown. So I, you know, when we're thinking about this space, we're often starting to think about, you know, as you hinted at, if there's something that we want or believe we need to measure, how do we find the right fit for purpose tools that we have confidence in an appropriately validated way for that use, can capture the data. People will fear the ability to properly deploy it and support it in the study and actually get the data back off of the device without any risk of loss or corruption. But then I think that the last note here, though, is around our almost fear of the analytics. And that, in many ways, to me, is the largest unknown. I feel like we know how to conquer some of those other areas around identifying tools or their validation or support in the field. But the analytics for some of this enormous streaming, high rates of sampling, multiple physiologic measures being sensed, is a huge analytics challenge for, I think, most pharma companies because it's outside of the scope of our traditional clinical trial statistics know-how. Do you find other groups emerging that can help life sciences companies to understand how to even begin to approach the analytics? Is this a capability at Scripps or that other academics are offering?
Sure. Let me just give a reference point. We just completed a trial that we're just publishing in the next couple of weeks here, where the data generated from the trial was generated a million data points a minute per patient. So let that sink in just a moment.
Yeah.
These are tremendous data sizes. So referencing back to my comment about genomics, it turns out that the biocomputational skill set of the folks you use in the genomics and actually is very similar to what you need in the digital medicine space. So we use a combination of assets here that include the San Diego Supercomputer Center, our computational biology resources that we share with our genomics colleagues, and then we are currently trialing a number of streaming data analytics systems that, frankly, some of them come from the medical industry, but the most interesting ones, at least so far to us, have come from other industries. The petrochemical industry and the jet engine industry are the two right now that are kind of standing out. And so these are industries that use that normally work with many, many sensors and many, many sets of data, streaming data, and they look for norms and non-norms. And what we're finding is you can find non-norms far earlier using the protocols that these other industries have used than you normally get using medically designed algorithms. In other words, medically designed algorithms typically say, if you see X, then that probably infers Y, whereas the other industries basically say, here's what the norm patterns look like. We don't even infer anything from them. And here's a non-norm, meaning it's not functioning the way that it does in its normal state. So therefore, there's something going on. Let's look at what's going on. And when you look at it from that perspective using the tools, you actually see things much earlier in time than you do using the medical models.
Don, I'm thinking about some of the different use cases that you've been alluding to, and some of them roll up to me as almost a diagnostic role, whether it's selecting a patient for a therapy or measuring an endpoint in a new way, and others are almost a co-therapy, a concomitant intervention that could perhaps be synergistic with the medicine and boosting overall outcomes. What use case do you feel like is going to really make an impact first? Where do you see a lot of the most energy or momentum right now?
Well, there's certainly a ton of activities around digital technologies and therapy management in diabetes. There are so many different kinds of examples there. It's you could go on for a couple of your shows talking about the different combinations. One of the ones, though, that I think we see a lot of promise coming along very, very quickly is in hypertension. And whether hypertension can now be measured by a watch, a wearable, by a smart patch, or by a device that's so easy to use you can just get more readings more frequently. And an example of that device might be a yet-to-be-approved device from Scanadu called the Scanadu Scout. That's just one example. There are many about to come onto the market that it changes the whole use case about how blood pressure is obtained. And as a result, you get more readings and more frequency. And as a result, we'll potentially know something about an area we really don't know very much about. Because, as I said, we've never had continuous blood pressure except when a patient's lying down in a bed in an ICU with an ART line. So we think the feedback loop there for therapy management titration is going to be one of the areas that's likely to have a kind of a change in practice, because we think the cost structure and the ease of use of, say, a disposable Band-Aid or of a watch will provide the feedback loop, which will not only educate and provide information, actual information to the healthcare professional, but also to the patient.
Well, I know I'm on my Scanadu Scout waiting list from the Indiegogo raise, so I certainly encourage everyone out there, wherever possible, to get their hands dirty and start, you know, having the opportunity to touch and use these tools wherever possible. Don, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, there may be some different impressions in people's minds of some of these tools. I think that some tools like a Fitbit have been really helpful in opening people's minds because they see these, they see how accessible they are, they see friends or neighbors wearing them. But there's kind of a difference between consumer-grade devices that may be more around fitness and some of the more clinical-grade tools that are out there, which are probably more the basis of a lot of your work. How do you describe or define kind of a separation of the tools people may be seeing so that they don't all get muddled into one pool together?
Well, actually, I think the reality of muddling is actually occurring. A number of the traditional validated tools are, as you are well aware, are expensive, and I would say not particularly well designed from an end-user experience, which is causing a number of clinical trials to be designed around using consumer tools as the data collection tool to either collect data for a longer period of time or plainly just to make the user experience with the patient more comfortable so there's less data dropouts as folks might otherwise become less compliant with the protocol. So I actually see right now a muddling of the two. And I can just, you know, a very good example is the difference between an actigraph, very well established in physical monitoring, and Fitbit, which is obviously a consumer product. In between that are some other validated products like the body media patch, which does activity and is actually FDA approved and well established, but not particularly heavily used in clinical trials. So actually, I would argue that in this case where we're talking about activity, there actually have been, frankly, somewhat easier to use devices for some time, but they haven't necessarily been adopted, perhaps because they only provided one level of data stream instead of helping capture and saving time and money on multiple layers of data acquisition. So I think the reality is here's the way I see this evolving. The market for digital health products is far bigger than the market for digital health products that make clinical trials more cost-effective. Therefore, there's going to be more money invested in developing products for the broader consumer and healthcare professional market that will ultimately be adopted into the clinical trial space for making trials more efficient than there is going to be money invested into tools to make clinical trials more efficient. And you're going to see more iterations and more turnover. So rather than what we're used to in the past, which is people developing technologies and bringing them to the clinical trials market, you're going to see technologies developed for the consumer and healthcare professional markets that the clinical trials industry picks up and says, I bet we could use that. And that's really what we're seeing in the marketplace.
But one of the challenges for us there is that many of the, and just to follow on that activity thread, many of the more consumer-facing activity monitoring devices at least don't seem to give that high-fidelity data that you were pointing at earlier, where I could get multiple axes with high rates of sampling. And instead, they're more oriented to processing all that information on board their device through their own proprietary algorithms and giving you some sort of number, which for a consumer is much easier to digest. But to a researcher who's looking to try and draw some inferences or to correlate it with a very specific disease state for their medication may be very limiting. Do you anticipate that some of those consumer-facing tools today may actually become more open and accessible with some of that raw data, or is there some other middle ground we'll be able to achieve?
No, I think the raw data will be available as the companies that have addressed the consumer market recognize there's another market they can serve. I mean, as you can imagine, many of these companies are just targeting a market. Their investment dollars they aggregated in order to bring the product to market may have been focused on either the healthcare professional market or the consumer market, not so much the clinical research market. And just to give some sense of scope there, last year, 2013, we finished the year with just over $2 billion invested by venture capital into digital health. This year we hit the $2 billion mark in June. So this is a very, very rapidly growing market that's actually capturing a good percentage of all the venture dollars being invested across all industries, a nice chunk of that. And many of them are going after larger markets. So if you're raising capital, whether it's strategic capital or venture capital, you're going to go after the largest markets. And frankly, the clinical trials market is not particularly a particularly large market. So I do think the trend is going to be first validate in the consumer market or in the healthcare professional slash payer slash health delivery markets, and then you will see adaption and open APIs and kind of freeing up of data streams to be used in other markets. In the meantime, you're absolutely going to see the consumer products used in phase four trials because it's cheap and easy, and frankly, the consumer is going to say, why do I want to use that clumsy device, which I'm not saying all devices in clinical trials are clumsy, but many of them are, when there's these consumer devices that look and feel and are more optimized for my lifestyle. So we're already seeing that happen, where in the phase four trials, the data collection is switching over to some of the more consumer-grade products.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and it follows a lot of what we've talked about in other settings around the convergence of traditional ePRO, where we've had very clinical-grade diaries and questionnaires that we put out for patients for them to self-report data, and in the real world, patients using very elegant and consumer-friendly tools that they're choosing to use to self-track and self-report data. And so it feels very analogous to expect there to be more convergence between the research tools and the tools that patients and consumers actually want to use to track much of the same information. Don, as we're kind of wrapping up our time slot, you know, we've seen in the last few couple of months some really high-profile announcements from Apple and Google and Samsung related to some of their initiatives to enable patients to pull more data together on their mobile devices from different tools, different sensors. I'm curious, you know, we talk a lot about disruption in this space, and in this case, it's not about disrupting pharma, meaning that we won't need medicines anymore, but we are talking about disrupting a lot of their process of how they might develop a medicine or go through a regulatory pathway. Who's going to be the big disruptor in this space that the folks that are listening today really need to be cognizant of and monitor and think about how they would engage?
So I'm going to answer that two different ways. I think the obvious disruptor to pharma's business model is the payer. And I think many of the pharma companies recognize how they get paid for drugs is likely to change. Some have been a little more vocal and a little more transparent about that. I think Sanofi has particularly led the pack in kind of adapting digital technologies. And frankly, at the end of the day, a lot of that has to do with the business model of how to get paid, and recognizing that in the future, a lot of drugs are going to be paid based on your ability to say this drug was appropriate for the patient, and here's why. Here's the test or the screen or something that actually narrowed the usage of the drugs to folks that was going to be effective on, or it's based on the outcomes achieved. Or it's based on some more of an integrated care program where actually the pharma company has actually assumed some financial risk. So with those three elements from a payer's perspective, that's the single largest disruptor facing the marketplace in the drug business. The second disruptor is going to be actually not so much in discovery as much as it is in data collection post-commercialization and then distribution. So if you think pharma might think of this as how do we increase compliance and therefore consumption, if compliance increases, consumption presumably increases. If consumption increases, then sales increase, utilization increases. When that happens, you start getting others interested in how is the product distributed. How do you make it easier for folks to get the product. And the best early example of that is Walgreens' very simple app that they started distributing about 3 years ago. When you picked up your drugs, they asked you if you wanted an app to go with that. And today, Walgreens fulfills a new refill every 1.6 seconds, 24/7, to the tune of well over $5 billion of prescription transactions off of an app. And those are the so as a result, they kind of essentially lock people into using Walgreens through pure convenience. And so these are the elements that I think are changing in the background, much less so than how you go about discovering a new molecule and how digital technologies, they'll have some impact around the edges, but it really comes down to how the technologies are going to be consumed and paid for and how additional data will be collected while the products are being used in the wild, so to speak.
You know, I said that that was going to be my last question, but I'm lying. So one last question after my last question, Don. You know, I think a lot of folks in this space may struggle with how to keep pace. They're deeply enmeshed in the science and the clinical issues around their disease area, and there's this whole other universe that's happening in the connected health, digital health, health 2.0 universe. Is there a way or a place that you would suggest folks being able to keep tabs or monitor? How would you, if you were a life sciences person, how would you, where would you go to keep a finger on the pulse?
Well, so this is really interesting because obviously the taxi industry did not see Uber coming. And when it came, it's had a huge impact on the, both the black car industry and the taxi industry and now around the world. And we've got a company now valued at $18 billion because they applied digital technologies to a very old transportation industry. And you kind of got to wonder what might happen in this space. And as you say, how do you stay on top or how do you watch for trends? So a couple of places I like. I like Health 2.0 as a conference. It's predominantly focused on the software side of things, but it's a good way to get an overview of lots of trends. I founded 10 years ago the Wireless Life Sciences Alliance, which is about applied wireless technologies and network and connectivity into life science products. And we run a business conference in May in San Diego and a scientific conference for engineering and clinical, and that's held at the NIH in October. So that's another event. A really fun event, one that is well underrepresented for the quality of the event and the quality of information, is put on by Leslie Saxon at the Center for Body Computing at the University of Southern California. It occurs in October. It's a one-day conference called Body Computing, and it is a wonderful overview that pulls the healthcare professional and the consumer space together in a really nice way. And if you want to be kind of surprised and shocked about what's underway, that's kind of the fastest one-day expertise to, place to go to find out what's going on. And then there are hundreds and hundreds of conferences out there. Many of them, frankly, aren't all that good because a lot of the for-profit conference industries are just kind of putting them on because there's obviously a lot of demand. They're literally you could go to one every day. But the ones I've just called out are some of the better ones and the places I would go to understand how the digital world is looking at the life science world and how the two are starting to kind of dance together.
That's great. Thank you, Don. And I'll look forward to seeing you in just a few weeks at a conference that's really focused on those life sciences folks to give them some visibility, the DFARM meeting in Boston, September 11 and 12. And we'll really sincerely look forward to seeing you there. Very much appreciate your time, Don Jones. And back over to you, Val.
Yeah, thank you both very much. And I think this is a great insight into what we are going to hear more of on the stage in Boston come a few weeks from now in September. So this was great, and thank you both. And that concludes our show.
Thank you.